So we appreciate you being here today. Today's session is important to us all. In 2017, as you all probably may have heard earlier in the Cattle Facts presentation, U.S. beef producers exported 1.2 million metric tons of beef worth $2 billion. This translates into significant value for your cattle. Mexico and Canada are two of the United States' leading trade partners, accounting for $980 million and $796 million in exports, respectively. The format of today's meeting is straightforward. Each panel participant will deliver some comments about their respective country's position of trade. And then we'll be able to follow up with a series of questions. So please make note of anything that you'd like to ask to any of us, and we'd be happy to answer those. On today's panel, we're pleased to welcome three individuals who are no strangers to trade discussions. First, John Maswall is the Director of Government and International Relations with the Canadian Cattlemen's Association. Based in Ottawa, John serves as a government and international relations liaison and spends the majority of his time as the voice for the Canadian beef industry to Canadian and U.S. governments, as well as maintaining international relations around the world. Our second participant is Alejandro Gomez Strossi. Oh boy. Alejandro, did I get that? Okay. Oof. Alejandro is a partner for International Trade and Customs for Gardier Wynn Sewell, a law firm providing advisory and consulting services related to international trade compliance, anti-dumping, customs, foreign trade, and Mexican administrative law. In this capacity, he works closely with Confederación Nacional de Organizaciones Ganaderas. Thank you. Okay. See, my childhood education worked out well for me, Mom and Daddy, to represent Mexican cattle interests in trade discussions. Our final panelist is Kent Backus, and a very, very good friend to me and a very good friend to our industry. In addition to be a proud Texas Tech Red Raider, you're welcome for saying that. No, just kidding. Kent's the Director of International Trade and Market Access at National Cattlemen's Beef Association. And he's a native Texan, and he's happy to be home, I would think. In this capacity, he represents U.S. beef industry trade efforts and has played a key role in helping open new markets to U.S. beef. We're pleased to have such a distinguished panel with us today, so thank you all for being here. Before we begin, I had the opportunity to actually join Kent and Colin Woodall in Washington, D.C. this past fall and speak in front of the House Ways and Means Committee, actually talking about CORUS and free trade agreements in the Asia-Pacific region, but just recently I participated in a panel about NAFTA. And as you all, I'm sure, have been watching the news quite often, obviously our trade situation is very much in the forefront. The one thing that I am consistently asked by producers of various sizes, again, whether they have 2, 20, 2,000, or 20,000 head, is why do I really need to pay attention to this? So I was discussing this with Kent earlier, and I thought it would be a great way to start off the session to find out, Kent, why do we all need to pay attention to what's taking place in the global marketplace?
Well, we're going to take the next hour to explain this question and dive into it, but probably one of the, I would say, the biggest reasons why trade matters to you as producers and to us overall is because free trade agreements allow us, and market access allows us, to actually maximize sales of the overall beef carcass, and that always directly impacts cattle prices, which impact your livelihoods. One number that we watch very closely is the overall value per head that's attributed to exports. And that has held at about $300 for the last few years. That's built into the cattle prices. So any impact there will impact cattle prices overall. Now that is an average of all the different cattle sales that we have. And there's obviously a diverse spectrum of quality and of, you know, some people who invest in niche markets and others who are producing for commercial markets. But at the end of the day, While it may impact some people more than others, it does impact each and every one of us. It also impacts us as consumers, because cheaper imports allow us to be able to purchase more. It also allows us to specialize. Instead of trying to produce everything domestically, we find what we're good at, we focus on that, and that's where we make our money, that's where our livelihood comes in. So, you know, overall, NAFTA has been a really interesting experiment in opening trade among our three economies, and really looking at what benefits we could all enjoy. When you look at NAFTA specifically, in essence, it is three bilateral trade agreements and under one central umbrella agreement. But these are individual trade agreements between the United States and Canada, the United States and Mexico, Mexico and Canada, but all under the agreement of one trade agreement. And that's why it's been very beneficial to us. One argument that is constantly debated is whether it's fair, whether it's equitable. And that really depends on if you look at the standards of trade or if you're looking for outcomes. And so that's an argument that was used during the 2016 presidential election. It's something that we continue to see today. And so the focus there has really honed in on the issue of trade deficits. And that's always a constant debate, is should we focus more on trade deficits or on trade barriers? And our goal today is to have an open conversation about this and the other segments of NAFTA. But before we dive into that, I think it's important to put in perspective exactly what our economic factors are and the other factors that we have as countries. When you look at population size, the United States is 326 million people, Mexico 131 million people, and Canada 35 million. The total GDP for the United States is 19.7 trillion, for Mexico 8.2 trillion, for Canada 1.5 trillion. When you look at our national herd sizes, this is both beef and dairy cattle combined. For the United States, we're around 94 million head. For Mexico, 32 million. In Canada, roughly 12 million, maybe a little more there. These are all combined into the North American economy. Obviously, the biggest consumer base of all three of those countries is the United States. So when you look at our overall exports, they're much smaller comparative to other countries, because this is where our consumer base is. About 85% of what we produce is for U.S. consumers. We dominate this market. American consumers love the high-end grain finished product that we produce here. But at the same time, Americans don't want to purchase all of the cuts that we produce from one cow. Americans don't prefer beef tongue. They don't prefer tripe. They don't prefer rounds. But in Mexico, we found that to be a really good market. Likewise, in Canada, you have a lot of production in the western provinces. We've been able to capitalize by providing beef into some of the eastern provinces. So North America, under this trade agreement, has really opened a lot of opportunities for us as a beef industry. But when you look overall at NAFTA, and that's where the bigger discussion is it fair? Is it equitable? Well, let's look at the actual trade deficits themselves. With trade with Canada, and this is from the U.S. Trade Representative's office, keep in mind. So 2016, U.S. goods and services, the two-way trade with Canada, totaled an estimated $627 billion. Exports were $320 billion. Imports were closer to $308 billion. And so the U.S. goods and services surplus was $12.5 billion. So we actually run a surplus with Canada when you combine those two. However, we run a trade deficit on goods. That deficit is at $12 billion, and the surplus on the services industry was $25 billion. So depending on how you look at this, we're either running a surplus or a deficit. And so that's been a big focus on NAFTA when it comes to Canada. With Mexico, our two-way trade with Mexico accounts for about $578 billion. Our exports were $262 billion. Our imports were $317 billion. There was a goods and services trade deficit of about $55 billion. And that's where a lot of the focus has been in this conversation with Mexico. And so when you look at this, depending on how you look at the facts, you get different stories. And so by looking at trade deficits, is that the actual place where we should focus, or should we look at the barriers to trade between our countries and with other countries in order to maximize those sales? But let's look at ag specifically. This is a report from the Congressional Research Service. Canada and Mexico are the two largest U.S. ag trading partners when you combine both imports and exports, accounting for 28% of the total value of U.S. ag exports and 39% of our imports. Under NAFTA, U.S. ag trade with Mexico has increased significantly. Exports were $8.7 billion in 1992. We've seen a $30 billion increase, at $38 billion in 2016. And so when you adjust for inflation, the growth in value of the total U.S. ag exports and imports within NAFTA has increased roughly threefold. And so when you look at ag overall, we import a lot of produce from Mexico. We import, timber and other agricultural goods from Canada. We have a very good trade economy, especially on the borders, but we are also able to fill a lot of gaps that are usually seasonal in nature. So when you look at the cattle industry specifically, some people who are opposed to NAFTA think that we're being flooded by live cattle imports. Well, let's look at the numbers. In 1993, that's the year before NAFTA went into effect, the combined total import of live cattle from both Canada and Mexico was around 2.5 million head. In 2017, that number was at 1.8 million. So you've actually seen a decline. Prior to NAFTA, the tariff was around 2.2 cents per kilo, and under NAFTA, it's duty-free. When you look at beef trade, this is where we've seen a shift in the dynamic. In 1993, our exports to Canada and Mexico combined for $660 million. When you look at 2017, as Kelly mentioned earlier, now that's a $2 billion, $2 billion market. We do run a trade deficit of $752 million with NAFTA countries, but we have a $1 billion surplus on our global economy, or our global beef exports. So the United States used to focus heavily on exporting to Canada and to Mexico. And our number one and number two markets, they used to be Canada and Mexico, and they would exchange almost annually of who was gonna be our top export market. Mexico usually led in volume, Canada would lead in value. And now, in the last few years, we've actually started to import more beef from Mexico than we export. And a lot of that's because we're focused more on the Asian markets now. You can look at the numbers there, Japan, Korea, they are bigger markets for us. Canada, that used to be our number one market, is in many ways our number four or number five market behind Hong Kong. And so we've really shifted to maximize our sales into those other countries. And so the question I would have for both Alejandro and John is, when we're looking at NAFTA, the focus really has been on these trade deficits. Should NAFTA be viewed as a zero-sum game? And how do you view trade deficits? And has NAFTA been beneficial, or has it hurt your producers?
Thank you, Kent. From the Mexican point of view, I think it is rather straightforward. It is not a zero-sum game in which trading, of course, in which one wins and the other one loses. If we think about it from another perspective, I think most of you run a trade deficit with your feed suppliers or your equipment suppliers, and that is not necessarily a bad thing at all. If you could buy more feed at cheaper prices, if you could buy more equipment at more reasonable prices or more even cheaper prices, I wouldn't see anyone complaining about it. But if we exclusively focus on trade deficit or surpluses by themselves, it is rather easy to see a partial picture of the entire international trade arena.
Thank you. I think, you know, the, you know, we get that question that Kelly asked a lot when I go to the county meetings or district meetings, usually above the curling hall, talking to cattle producers in Canada. You know, they ask, why should we care? And, you know, we try to kind of explain it that sort of a simple way that I think everybody gets. You know, the average Canadian likes to eat steaks and roasts and burgers, not so much lungs and tongues and livers and others, those other things. And if you think that you're raising an animal, you sell it to somebody who is going to disassemble that animal and sell the parts. And the way that they're going to be able to pay you the most for that animal is by being able to sell each of those parts to the customer that values it the most. And usually that customer is not in Canada. So if you think of a tongue, example, if we can't export that tongue to the customer that wants to pay the most for it, it's probably going to sell in the 20, 30 cent a pound range for, you know, pet food, going to pet food. You know, you think of what a tongue weighs, 4 or 5 pounds, maybe a little more. And if you can get $5 or $6 a pound for it in the Japanese market, you know, you do the math of what that adds. And then you do that same math on lungs and other pieces that are undervalued in the domestic market. And that adds up to that, you know, $300 an animal that Kent is talking about. I think the other thing that maybe makes the answer to that question a little easier in Canada, this is really finding the silver lining in things, is we lost all of our export markets overnight in 2003. And, you know, we're fortunate that that's back, but we saw the price impact of when you have more cattle that need to be marketed every week than there are places to market them. And there is no bottom to the market when you're in that scenario. You know, so people understand pretty quickly, and that's why we're pretty committed to making sure that we have open markets all around the world and are working to address those barriers.
So I think, you know, one of the other things that we continue to look at is under NAFTA, we have seen for the last 25 years, our industry has really adapted to become more fluid with North America trade. When you look at the percentage of our cattle imports versus our actual slaughter and overall herd size, it's very, very small. And really, a lot of those imports, they come to the United States. We purchase them when it comes, especially with calves coming over from Mexico. We put U.S. investment into those animals. Then we send them to our feed yards, our processing facilities. And with Canada, it's a lot of the same way. You know, anytime we see a disruption in that North American supply chain, that's when we start to see more uncertainty with feed yards, with packing facilities. And there's a lot of concern that if they're not running at those optimal levels, they can't run efficiently, then they get mothballed, they get closed. That means that we have fewer people to start selling our cattle to, fewer people to compete and to get a good price for those. And that's a bigger concern. Kelly, you are someone who has traveled as a producer to some of these export markets. And when you testified in front of the House Ways and Means Committee, and by the way, she's one of the best witnesses we've ever seen testify there. She did an excellent job. You should be very, very proud of her. So, Kelly, now that I've built you up, why don't you talk a little bit about the interaction you've had with some of these foreign consumers and what that meant for you as a producer and kind of the responses you received from some of our customers, especially in these overseas markets.
Sure. So last May, I was able to travel with U.S. Meat Export Federation with a delegation from Texas, Oklahoma, and Colorado to Korea and Japan, our two largest trading partners. And as a producer, and really that's what I was going as, you. I was going there to see what their desire for our product is and the adoption that they had it into their lifestyle. I came back emboldened, so to speak. In fact, I don't know if Jim Lovell is here or not in the room today. He was with me. I know Jackie and John Means were there too, but I know we had this discussion frequently as we all were traveling through the two countries just to see how exciting it was to see particularly those in the Asia Pacific markets desire for U.S. beef. Ironically, in Japan, for example, as you all know, we currently have a 50% tariff on our chilled beef that actually is going to be going away at the end of this month, thankfully. But it was a snapback tariff that was triggered because of the overall volume of beef that we had been exporting specifically into Japan. And regardless of even that tariff increase, we saw exports in the Japanese market continue to increase through 2017, and the trend is still that way for 2018, which is very exciting. I will actually be going back to Japan in May, and I am so curious to see. We're going to be visiting some of the same people that I saw. These were the processors, these were the marketers of our beef, and I'm going to be curious to see what the difference has been in a year. If there has been any, if we're seeing increased demand, because that's what's going to be so important. Now, as you all are aware, Japan is one of the member countries that was part of the TPP that we are no longer a part of. It does exist with those other member nations. We do not currently have a bilateral trade agreement in place with Japan. And we as producers, in my opinion, really need to have a conversation with our legislators to have them aggressively pursue these bilateral trade agreements, particularly with Japan. CORUS, which is the Korean Free Trade Agreement, that was under threat as well. Again, that's our second largest trading market at this point in time. It's being examined also. Once more, critical that we continue to have a free market access for our beef, for our product. When it comes to our trading partners with NAFTA, who are sitting here to my right, we in Texas, I think we all would agree, enjoy a wonderfully unique relationship and have seen tremendous success under NAFTA. We have been a tremendous beneficiary of that agreement, and it is in our best interest at this point in time to just continue to talk. And I know that's what Kent and Colin Woodall and our wonderful staff at NCBA continues to do with the administration, that we continue to keep that free market access with our trading partners. That is our best bet as producers. If we were to eliminate that $300 of value for every calf that we're selling at the sale barn, and that's really what it comes down to, that's money in our pockets. $300 a head could go away, as you said, overnight. Like it did in 2003. That is frightening to me. And how is we as an industry continue, how are we supposed to sustain ourselves and how are we supposed to stay in business? So again, I would implore all of us sitting in this room as producers to continue to have conversations with our legislators to let them really fully appreciate the ramifications that these trade decisions are making on our industry.
Thank you, Kelly. And I think she brings up a very important point, and that's the fact that, you know, we were very strong supporters, very vocal supporters of the Trans-Pacific Partnership for one of many reasons, obviously Japan being the big market, but also one reason why we really supported Canada and Mexico being part of TPP was to help address some issues that had not been addressed in NAFTA. This was a way to modify NAFTA. Really, it was a way to improve upon the agreement without having to renegotiate. And so had we passed TPP, we would have addressed a lot of issues that were in there. So that kind of brings me to my next question, and is now we're in the middle of these negotiations. When the White House announced its intent to renegotiate or potentially withdraw from NAFTA about this time last year, NCBA, CNOG, and the Canadian cattlemen were all united in a joint statement to the president, and to our presidents and the prime minister of Canada to say, you know, don't jeopardize the beef access that we have. Keep your negotiations narrow in scope. Let's move this as quickly as possible and let's get on to to really focus on tearing down trade barriers in other places. So with that, you know, Alejandro, John, my question would be, you know, what changes are your countries pursuing under these NAFTA negotiations? And do you think that given the political situations in all three of our countries, do you think it is reasonable that we could see, I would say, a good conclusion or any changes in the near future?
We should keep in mind that NAFTA is simply a contract between countries. It was, as we all know, signed in 1994. I just heard a number a couple days ago in which the rule of origin for automobiles were made considering a 1992 automobile. I think there's hardly any 1992 automobiles out there, at least running. Well, in Mexico there are quite a few. However, not here in Texas though. So to begin with, yes, the rule of origin may need some adjustment. But for rules of origin for automobiles, there are some other large issues, say sunset clauses, meaning that whether or not every 5 years the NAFTA should be renegotiated or terminated automatically if not renewed. There's an dispute settlement provision and some anti-dumping provision. So again, but for automobiles, the other three outstanding relevant issues do concern cattle and beef trade, meaning dispute resolution, anti-dumping matters, and the sunset clauses. With that in mind, we should always, and I'll touch upon some statement made earlier today in the cattle facts session in this very same room, in which the only way to increase the selling or the sales of the U.S. in beef and cattle industry is by increasing demand. And there's, even though we try really hard, as I know from last night and from lunch, we try to keep demand of beef very strongly in the U.S. However, that is only a way that can be done equitably and very forward-looking, that is expanding markets. With that in mind, in Mexico, we do have 12 treaties with 46 countries, and I think we're very aggressively moving towards that statement, and I think I see the U.S. moving backwards in the opposite direction. That is baffling to me. I do not understand how would the U.S. government would try to see a market increase by threatening a very significant trading partners.
I guess what I've seen so far in this negotiation, it's not a normal negotiation in the sense that we're used to seeing how a free trade agreement gets negotiated. And I guess that kind of flows from how this renegotiation started. You know, the United States said, we want to renegotiate or we're going to withdraw. And, you know, so we didn't ask for that scenario, but we actually saw some good opportunities to do this, and Canada agreed pretty quickly to be part of that. And, you know, what we see is that there's really two main tracks of things that are happening. Sometimes you hear this referred to as a modernization initiative, and sometimes as a renegotiation. Well, it's both. There's a lot of work that is going on really below the radar screen, not being written about in the papers. You know, it's not very sexy stuff to talk about how we're going to change the recognition of equivalency on, you know, this or that. But, you know, in the more than 25 years since they negotiated NAFTA, we've each negotiated other agreements with other countries and thought of different ways to do things. Technology's evolved, and there really is genuine effort and you know, good collaborative effort to modernize it. And that's just humming along quite well. Then there's the renegotiation part. And so far, that has largely been the United States making sort of win-lose demands. A number of demands that are aimed at getting back to addressing the trade deficit, as opposed to finding ways for both sides to benefit, or all three sides to benefit. You know, and that's been fairly counterproductive, in particularly in the early rounds. So normally in a negotiation, you would have a period of time where the sides explore everything that's been going on and the issues, and agree on what are the numbers and the data, and then at some point they would make a mutual decision to decide to launch negotiations. Well, that exploratory period has been happening after the negotiations have launched. So there was some frustration early on that things weren't moving very quickly. They were having very frequent negotiating rounds, right, you know, one after the other. You know, normally the negotiators, they like to explore, they like to then have time to go back and evaluate and say, well, you know, that was an interesting idea, we wouldn't have thought it that way, but, you know, maybe we can take something on and find a creative compromise. So in the early several rounds, that wasn't happening, and it seemed very confrontational, very, very negative. I think it really turned a corner during the sixth round in Montreal, and so now we've had a seventh and waiting for the eighth. So the rounds have been getting longer in duration with more time in between for that more normal process to happen. And I've actually felt quite a bit more positive these last couple months that this is going to have a good conclusion to it. Started to see more flexibility, more creativity. So in terms of things that we're looking at, you know, on the beef side, I think we're all in agreement. We said it in our statement that we like the cattle and beef trade the way it is. No tariffs, no quotas. We like the rules of origin. Let's not bring country of origin labeling back. We've done that, tried that, failed. It was counterproductive for all three of us. And but there are some things that can work better in terms of how the border functions, make it more efficient, less cost for people moving product in each of the directions.
You know, I think one of the biggest developments has been the general agreement on the sanitary and phytosanitary chapter. There are a lot of things that we wanted to accomplish there, you know, to help really expedite the process. To put that in perspective, it's kind of like getting socks for Christmas. You're not really excited about it, but you're pretty glad you have it later on. And so, wow, that joke failed. But anyways, with NAFTA overall, I think, you know, one of the other things for the United States has been we have not had negotiators confirmed by the U.S. Senate until the last month or so. We haven't had a chief agriculture negotiator until just a few weeks ago. And now we have him in place. His name's Greg Dowd. Some of you probably have met Greg before. You know, we're very excited that he's in that position. But we still have a lot of problems to tackle when it comes to agricultural trade. I know one of the things that we're hearing just through some of the testimonies this last week, through both Ambassador Lighthizer, who's the U.S. Trade Representative, and Secretary Ross from the Department of Commerce, is that the administration's taking a wide-open approach really trying to tackle some longstanding trade issues. You know, President Trump was elected to shake things up. He's put people in place that have that similar sentiment. Good or bad, whether you agree with it or not, that applies to regulatory change, it applies to a lot of other things, but also applies to trade. And, you know, in agriculture, we've been very comfortable with a very pro-trade agenda over the last decade that's really helped us increase our exports and increase our bottom lines. And so, you know, that's really been our focus, has been to try to push for more trade agreements. And unfortunately, as Alejandro mentioned, it now seems the United States is set, you know, really pushed the pause button there and has said, okay, before we go forward and look for other agreements, let's go back and change the ones that we have. Meanwhile, other countries are already pursuing trade agreements. We've already seen the remaining TPP countries move forward by finalizing that trade agreement that will be implemented very soon. So my question is, before I get to that, from the U.S. perspective, in exchange for not moving forward with TPP, we were promised action on bilateral trade agreements. We still have not seen any action there. And And that's a big priority for NCBA. Something we have asked the administration to really double down on is to try to pick up the pace there. But I'm curious to hear from Alejandro, from John, about the other trade agreements, where you're looking at outside of NAFTA, outside of TPP. What trade agreements are Canada and Mexico looking to move forward with?
As I mentioned, we do have a vast number of trade agreements that we're actually continuing with that effort, namely the Pacific Alliance, which is the Mercosur and South American free trade agreement with Mexico. We have an existing free trade agreement with the European Union, and we are also opening up some quote-unquote threatening markets such as Brazil and Argentina. So that is, again, an ongoing effort. And I will be shifting fairly quickly to the political situation in Mexico, because I know we're running out of time, in which we will have presidential elections in early July. And that is going to be seen, NAFTA renegotiation, meaning is going to be seen as a very hot topic, in which perhaps not so much as to the benefits or threats of FTA, of free trade agreements, but for a national sentiment being laid on the floor on all while renegotiating a free trade agreement. So we will be seeing the discussions between the three major parties, one leftist, one right wing, and one in the middle. The one more predominant is the one in the left by Mr. López Obrador, which might be, as we're advancing, opposed to NAFTA, or at least opposed to being or following the road of free trade negotiations. That is very threatening to Mexico, but every single attack that is made upon Mexico, it simply strengthens the position of the leftist Mr. López Obrador party.
Yeah, we've got a very busy agenda for negotiating agreements and access. Canadian Cattlemen's Association, we were one of the strongest supporters of resurrecting the TPP, if not the most insistent in Canada. And we were very happy to get that done. And back to the, you know, what's the benefit? You know, when it looked like the meeting in Da Nang in Vietnam in November, when Canada was one of the problem children, that maybe was going to undermine that from happening, the feedback we were getting from meat importers in Japan, suddenly Canada is an unreliable supplier. And even though nothing had changed on access, they were expecting an improvement in access, and now suddenly we were unreliable. But then in January, when the deal was done and Canada was at the front of that, we just did a trade mission to Japan a few weeks ago with the minister, and suddenly we're hearing from Japanese meat suppliers that Canada is now being viewed as a preferred beef supplier into their market. So we're pushing to get that agreement implemented as soon as possible, probably maybe around the end of this calendar year or very early 2019. And when that happens, the first six to ratify it will implement it right away, and ultimately all 11 come in. But we want to make sure we're one of those first six, because we're pretty sure Japan will be. We know Australia's already got its free trade agreement, so here we are paying 38.5% duty into Japan. Australia's down in the 26% range. We're subject to a beef safeguard of up to 50%, but with the TPP, we are immediately going to have our tariff drop to reach parity with Australia, and we will no longer be subject to that 50% tariff. So, you know, we feel pretty good about being able to massively increase our exports into the Japanese market on that. We've also now got our deal with Europe. We still have some technical issues we have to work through, but we're seeing very high dollars per kilo on what has been going into Europe. It's exceeding, it's close to $16 a kilo in the European market, so that's going to be very beneficial. Of course, the United Kingdom is leaving, so we're going to have to negotiate with them. I think there's an understanding that the Europe agreement we have, that they will sort of do that with them on a transitional basis. I would expect to see Canada launch very soon trade negotiations with China. And we did launch with Mercosur recently, although that's not a huge priority for us on that one. Our feedback to the Canadian government is, you know, agreements, if they're good for some sector in Canada, you know, and the agreement with Mercosur is probably going to be very good for equipment manufacturers, mining sectors, some other sectors. When Canadians do well and have jobs, they eat more beef. So even if we don't benefit directly, if the economy is growing, the beef sector is going to do very well.
So we've taken the last 30 minutes or so to ramble up here. I think we'd like to take a few questions from the audience. Kelly, we'll let you take
sure.
it from there.
Does anybody have any questions specific to NAFTA or maybe trade in general? Or any of the topics that we've discussed or maybe didn't touch upon for perhaps? Any questions? I have one question, actually. Should we be focused in this whole conversation on trade deficits or trade barriers? I mean, what's going to be most beneficial for us as producers? What is it that we should really be focusing upon?
The trade, whether it's a trade deficit or a trade surplus, shouldn't be the primary focus. You know, it's an indicator.
Right.
It'd be an indicator of, well, should we look at something if we're consistently buying more than we're selling? But I think it's also important to look at, what do you buy? What do you sell? Are the things that you're importing, are they inputs that get used to add value and generate jobs and economic activity? What is the size of the deficit or surplus in relation to the overall trade? You know, I know with China, the deficit is rather huge.
Right.
There's the debate as to whether there is a deficit or a surplus with Canada. When you look at all trade of goods and service, the U.S. has a surplus. If you look at it just on goods, it's a small deficit, less than 2% of the overall trade relationship. So, you know, the real question is, rather than just look at things at a point in time, what is the trend? You know, we have 25 years worth of experience with NAFTA, and that experience is, in just about every year, we both increased our trade with the other, with the exception of the 2008-2009 period, and we know that what bad years those were. So we want to keep it growing and not get overly focused on whether it's a deficit or surplus.
Very good.
A very quick note from my end. Out of every single dollar that Mexico exports to the United States, 40 cents of that dollar comes or is U.S. originated, meaning we import middle products that eventually get manufactured or processed in Mexico and then shipped back to the U.S. So it is just simply focusing on the large number as to whether, and it's a very catchy phrase of the trade deficit, however, again, it's a very narrow and subjective issue that if we translate it, as I mentioned earlier, to our feed suppliers or your local supermarket, there's nothing to be angry about it. I think if we keep the market growing, as John mentioned, I think it's a virtuous circle that we should enhance.
And just from the U.S. side, I'll be quick about this. We are in a highly specialized economy. There are very few places where we produce and manufacture every single part of something and then finish it, and it rolls off the line. We're very good at producing one part only, and producing it efficiently and safely. And then we do that in a lot of different areas and bring them in and we're able to finish them together. We're much more efficient in our shipping, our transportation. It's because we have this open access between our countries. But trade deficits, they are important. And I think, as John mentioned, you have to look at the causes. Because if we're importing a lot without exporting, if we don't have the export counterpart, then that's not good for us in the long run. So what we should focus on is being able to export more and to maximize what we do. And you do that by tearing down trade barriers. One example in particular that we have was, it's beef specific. As you'll remember, up until 2013, from 2008 to 2013, we had a restriction on the age of the cattle for beef that was going to Japan. They had to be slaughtered before they reached 21 months of age, which meant the supply was very, very small. It was very small. Now the premiums on those cows were high because it was a small supply. So when we were able to get that age restriction lifted to 30 months, that opened the supply. That made it a lot more competitive for more people in the industry. And it actually increased our exports by almost $600 million. So when you look at tearing down those trade barriers, it doesn't necessarily have to be tariffs. It can be the non-tariff things as well. That opens up more opportunities for us, and it makes us more competitive. And that has really helped us improve that trade imbalance of imports and exports. It's made us a net exporter for many years.
Very good. And yes, George.
That's an excellent question. Actually, the question was, for those of you who couldn't hear, is it was on the timing of negotiating a bilateral deal with Japan. We're optimistic. We hope that will start very soon. There have been high-level talks between Vice President Pence and the finance minister, the trade minister from Japan. In the hearings this week, the U.S. Trade Representative, he made comments about how they're really going to try to expedite these bilateral agreements. He didn't say Japan specifically, but we know that is on the agenda for agriculture, for manufacturing, for services, and for the administration. So we're hopeful that will happen soon. We've certainly been applying pressure to encourage them to do that, because that's our biggest concern, is we're going to lose that competitive advantage in our biggest export market.
And I'll say, like when I testified in front of Ways and Means, there was a desire on both sides of the aisle, I felt, from the committee, that they were, there was a clear understanding that these bilateral agreements were something that we needed to pursue aggressively, and it was bipartisan, which is really unusual in Washington, D.C. these days, I think we would all agree. So I was encouraged by seeing that. I just hope that it translates to real time. So there was one more question, I think, Joan. Yes, sir. Question was about monetary exchange rates. That's an interesting dynamic that isn't often brought up in the conversation and is very critical to this as well. So.
Yeah, and it's a huge factor, particularly in agriculture trade, resource, primary industry type trade, that you'll see the trade flows swing quite significantly from year to year based on what the exchange rates might be. So, you know, it kind of comes back to the question about deficits and surpluses.
Right.
You know, whether it happens one year or another, you got to then ask yourself, well, why? Why are the trade flows shifting? And it's all kinds of factors, and that's an important one of them. We know weather is going to be an important one of them. You know, in terms of feeder cattle trade over the border, the Canadian-U.S. border has an awful lot to do with the price of Alberta barley versus Nebraska corn, which has an awful lot to do with weather and growing conditions and yields and those sorts of things. So there's all kinds of factors that you need to look at.
I also think if you can look at our industry, for example, one reason why Canada was a very good export market for us is because the U.S. dollar and the Canadian dollar was actually slightly higher than the U.S. dollar mm-hmm. several years ago. Since then, the U.S. dollar has recovered. It's been very strong. And as a result, we've become a little more expensive in Canada. Not to plug tourism for Mexico or Canada, but the difference in currency makes it pretty cheap to travel there right now. But that also makes exports less competitive. When the dollar is weak, that's when you see our exports are definitely more affordable and more competitive. The big concern has been, has that currency been manipulated? And that was also a big theme, and there's a lot of nuance there we don't have time to go into. The administration has definitely made the issue of currency manipulation as a priority in many discussions, but also in factoring in whether other countries are bad actors. Now the question will be is there actual evidence to show that countries are putting policies into place to artificially drive down the value of their currencies? And if so, do they do that to manipulate trade? We have international bodies in place, the G20 and others, where they can actually look at this. And Japan was guilty of this nearly a decade or so ago, maybe longer. And they were called to the carpet by the international community, and they changed their ways. Big question is, China and the focus there. Will there be international effort to address that? But the U.S. is a base currency. We're always viewed as kind of hypocritical on currency manipulation, because when the Fed moves policies different ways, the U.S. could be accused of that as well. So it's definitely an issue that needs to be discussed. I think that trade discussions themselves are complicated enough without throwing that grenade in the middle of the negotiations. We definitely need to have those conversations. I think there are arguments to be made on both sides of how they would impact trade. But as far as formal negotiations go, I don't know how you find a win-win situation by doing that within a trade framework. So we'll see how that plays out, but it's definitely something that's not going to go away anytime soon.
Currency exchange rate, very briefly, is a very good example of how everything is interconnected. As you might have seen or in the news lately, there's a safeguard or a national security safeguard regarding aluminum and steel. How can that affect trade in beef? It can, because the exclusion of Canada and Mexico is subject to a sufficient or a satisfiable solution to the U.S. government in NAFTA renegotiations. And that can happen, or that should happen, as early as the end of May. Because if by the end of May there's no a sufficient or a satisfiable renegotiation of NAFTA, Mexico and Canada can impose countervailing, I don't want to get too technical, but retaliatory measures on U.S. exports. And what would be targeted? Those that are most irritant, of course, products, namely produce and other products that are made in those states from the Congress that acted or did not act upon that.
Very good. Any more questions? One more, and it's going to have to be our last one. Yes, sir. Do you have any comments to that?
Well, I'd say what's been very much on my mind as Canada potentially approaches a free trade negotiation with China is how do you write down an agreement with a centrally controlled economy that doesn't have the same concept of the rule of law as we do here in Canada, the United States. You know, we feel pretty good that we've got a very similar legal tradition, similar courts. When we write an agreement, we have a fairly good idea how it's going to be enforced. It's a whole different deal with a different culture, but that's, you know, you look at it, the potential makes it worth it. There's a lot of potential over there. We've just got to figure out how to do it right.
Ironclad. If there are no more questions, John, Alejandro, Kent, thank you all for being here very much. Thank you all for participating and being here.